This is Dr. David Stevens, your host on Christian Doctor's Digest. And as always, it's great to get together with you. And we've got some great interviews that I want you to hear. We're going to talk about difficult situations. You know, as an old missionary, I always have a keen interest in missions. And one of the topics that's hot and continues to be hot is how you take the gospel into difficult-to-access countries. And we're going to be talking to Joseph Daniel. That's a pseudonym. We're not going to give you his real name. But talk about marketplace missions in the 1040 window. Some of the strategies that can help carry the gospel into places where it's very difficult to get an opportunity to do that. And then we're going to go back to a perennial favorite. Dr. John Patrick's going to join me here at the microphone. I know you're going to enjoy that. And I don't have to convince you we're living in a difficult time in our country, difficult time in our world, a lot of challenges in healthcare and just in culture. And he's going to share some foundations of life that can help not only you and your kids, but helping your colleagues as they deal with some of these issues. And he, as usual, has some rich insights. Well, let's get to that first guest. It's a pleasure to introduce you to Joe Daniel. He's an American-trained physician. He's a marketplace worker. He's using his physician skills to attain a precision visa to a closed and unreached country. Closed in the sense that the typical missionary cannot enter the country, and unreached, there's no witness for the gospel there. And for the last 4 years, he and his wife and four children have been working in Asia. And I want to give you some insights of things that he has learned and opportunities that exist and the how-tos of how this is done. It may be something you want to consider or know younger people who are interested, and you can give them guidance as well after you get this information. Let's get to what Joe has to say. Joe, it's great to have you on Christian Doctor's Digest, and we really wanted to focus today on marketplace ministry, something that you're doing, and I think many people are really not that aware of, and that is missions where you go into somewhere that's difficult and actually may have employment or hold a job there in some way that the government sees you doing medical more than and not missions. Tell me about your journey. Let's start there, and then we'll kind of get into the particulars. And I know we're going to keep things confidential, but what can you tell us?
So first of all, I just want to thank the opportunity to speak with you and to speak to your audience. It's a great honor to be here. So my journey, I think, is pretty typical of a lot of young medical students that are interested in missions. I did some things in undergrad. I did some things in as a medical student. And primarily, you know, I actually did a missions trip with CMDA to Ecuador. So my missions sort of history started in the short-term world. I went to Guatemala, went to Haiti, went to Ecuador. And I did a lot of places where the gospel is known. And there's extreme poverty. So you do a lot of poverty alleviation as a physician. And that was kind of when I got married to my wife. We had said we were going to go somewhere for 2 years as missionaries. And my wife is also a physician. And we were kind of on that more traditional path of we were going to probably end up like in Ecuador or South Africa, in a place that where Christ is known, but we would do a lot of poverty alleviation. And through my experience post-residency, I was lucky enough to meet a man who was actually working in Asia, and he was a ER physician, and he was working in Asia, and he was working there intentionally as a what he would call himself as a missionary, paying his own way. And it absolutely just kind of blew my mind that as a model for missions, you could do something like that, because he wasn't in a poor country. And it was kind of the first time in my life that I realized that missions doesn't necessarily have to be about poverty. And when I talk about this, to be clear, if that's where you're called, I'm not against poverty alleviation. One of my best friends works in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and he deals with the issues of massive poverty. But for me, it was very eye-opening to think, well, actually, I could go to a place that's 100% Muslim and I could pay my own way. So as a result of this interaction with this kind of mentor of mine that was in Asia, my wife and I started looking into what does missions mean? What historically has it done? We, you know, worked in through the perspectives course. We talked to other people and we started to see the idea that the Great Commission is about making disciples. And certainly a portion of that is healing them physically, providing for them physically. But if you look at historically, and at least where the state of the church is right now, most of the sort of church planting need, not the poverty need, but the church planting need, tends to be in the Hindu and Muslim world. And so based on that, we started looking in that direction. And then we came across, which I am convinced why doctors should go, is that nobody can go to these places. I was shocked. The typical missionary, you know, maybe the person that has seminary, the person that has language, these countries don't give them visas. The only people that can get in are doctors, nurses, engineers, pilots. So there is this huge need. So I ended up in Asia, not necessarily because I felt a particular call to Asia, but I did feel a call to obedience of the Great Commission, and I can go. And that is why I'm so passionate about trying to get more medical people to follow behind me, because I really do feel that for most of these countries, and if you look at the 1040 window or where the unreached world is, these are primarily closed countries, closed to the traditional missionary, but they have a huge, huge need for Western expertise as far as engineers, lawyers, doctors, dentists, that type of thing. So I always say that at the end of the day, I really do believe that the Great Commission is going to be completed. It may have been started by the missionaries, the traditional missionaries, but I think it's going to be completed by us, by marketplace workers, by doctors, because we're the only ones who can go.
Yeah, and I agree with you. You know, as people go into these countries, and there's a lot of ways to do it, but often people in business and whatever get found out and then they get thrown out. But if you go in healthcare, even when you get found out, usually you don't get thrown out because people need you so much and need that expertise and value as a, because of your profession. And of course, the hope is you won't get found out at all. But tell me how that journey has gone for you as with what you can tell us, because you know, it's one thing to get a job and in a place like this. Second part of it is how do you do ministry cross-culturally in this type of situation where you have to be careful how you go about it?
So a couple things that I would is to try and define some terms here that I do not consider myself a tent maker. I am a marketplace worker. And I know it sounds like you're splitting hairs, but when you ask what your evangelistic life looks like, a tent maker, and again, I'm not saying this is a bad model. One of my best friends in the country I'm in does this model. A tent maker, they have a skill where they get in to a certain country and then they try to do as minimal amount of that work to keep that visa. And then their real job is out evangelizing, church planting, you know, out at coffee shops and parks and type thing. So that is a legitimate model. The marketplace worker model, and a lot of this, I think there is some agreement, some disagreement, but most people would say the marketplace worker model, your evangelism is your work. And so the question that I often get is, in my context, I work about 60 hours a week. And so people then will say to me, well, when are you going to do your real job? As if, when are you going to do your missional evangelistic job? And my answer to that is, I work 60 hours a week. I get to do 60 hours of ministry a week. So the marketplace worker model is bringing a blessing to the country. And I often say it's kind of a model of maybe like Nehemiah. It's a model like Joseph, not a model like Daniel. It is not the model necessarily of a Paul or a Peter. It's not to say that you can't do that, but first and foremost, your evangelistic method as a marketplace worker is your work. And the reason I bring that up is we need technically excellent physicians. And what I mean by that is if you're a surgeon and you're a marketplace worker, you better have the lowest infection rate and post-op rate of any of your partners. If you are a family practice doctor, your patients better have the lowest A1Cs and the best blood pressure control. Because in my context, and I've seen this, I work all the people that I work around that are other missionaries or workers, they're all marketplace workers. If you do your job with excellence and you do it with love, then they will find you. And it's interesting, you asked about being found out. there was a nurse who recently left for family reasons, but she was South African. She was in a hospital in my country for about 15 years. She was so good at her job as a nurse that they made her a trainer of nurses. And she was so good at that, that then they made her a trainer of physicians as bedside manner. And she was so good at that, then they eventually made her a trainer for executives. All the while, she was running Bible studies in the hospital. And the religious police knew this. She had been found out, but they couldn't touch her. They absolutely could not touch her because she was bulletproof, because she was such a good nurse. The hospital could not afford to leave her. And when she finally went home, she had to go home for family reasons. She was definitely found out, but she left on her own terms. The hospital CEO was begging her to stay because she was such a good nurse. All the while, she's running Bible studies with Muslims in her hospital. So I think as a marketplace worker, your evangelism is going to start in relationships. It's going to start in professional excellence. It's going to start in being the guy that everyone knows they can come to, because in the Muslim context, there's so much deceit. There's so much incompetence. They love certifications, but they have no competency, that they will come find you. And if you make yourself invaluable, it doesn't matter if you get found out. You become so valuable to the hospital from a medical standpoint, they can't afford to lose you.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that very much so. And our competence is one of our greatest witnesses in this country and abroad. I mean, it opens the doors. I remember C. Everett Koop, the former Surgeon General, saying, if you're not competent, don't tell anybody you're a Christian. Kind of reverse to what you're saying, but still the same truth. So what else would you say that you've learned and seen as you've served in this type of role?
I think the other issue, I do a lot of mobilizing with other physicians, and I think physicians, nurses, and doctors, we spend a lot of time preparing to get through school. We tend to be very driven. We tend to be a certain personality. And I can tell you, I have talked to surgeons that, you know, they could be dealing with a ruptured AAA, blood's gushing everywhere, and they're super calm and cool. But then you tell that same surgeon, I want to make you into a church planner, and they start to get an upset stomach and sweaty hands. So I do think one of the barriers to this is, as a medical person, if you're going to do marketplace working, you don't have to be this Ravi Zacharias. You don't have to know the Bible inside out. You're not going to be handing out Bibles. You don't have to argue. But a lot of what you're going to do, and I think a lot of, and when I talk to physicians, you are probably already being so evangelistic right now that you're not even aware of it because you are surrounded by other Christians. And the example that I give is that if you go into a dark room and you light a match, just that little tiny bit of light, everyone in the room will see that match. But most Christians in the West, they're in a room full of flashlights. So when I say, how can you be evangelistic through marketplace excellence, through technical excellence? To give you a good example, I'm in a group of 30 ER physicians. I'm probably the only one that shows up on time. So that's a really big deal that you show up in time. Another issue is I'm in a hospital that teaches residents and nurses and doctors. Generally, in the Muslim world, they are taught through the honor and shame principles. And so, as I said before, there's lots of certificates, but very little competency because the way that they are taught is by shaming them. So you have a resident that's trying to do a complex procedure, complex laceration, lumbar puncture, and they fail, they get shamed. And so they never actually learn how to do it. So I am known actually in my hospital as the guy who will teach. I'm an ER physician, but I often have other residents coming to me saying, hey, can you help me put this central line in? Can you do these things? Because it gets out very quickly. I'm not going to shame you. I will help you. I will make you technically excellent, but I will do it with love so that then they start to come to me. They start to ask you questions. And another example of this that I often talk about, evangelistic, how you do this as a physician, is, for example, there was a time once where in my group, there were six of us working in the ER. There were six physicians on. And in my group, I am the only Christian. And actually, quite frankly, as far as I know, I'm the only Christian physician in the entire medical staff. And one of my partners, who is a Muslim, he brought his daughter to our emergency department. And it's interesting. He actually was supposed to go another section of the ER. There were six ER physicians on. I was the only Christian. He came to me grabbed me, wanted me to see his daughter. I wasn't in the right section. I wasn't supposed to be seeing kids that day, but he came and found me. He had a choice of five of us or six of us, and he chose me. And I'm pretty certain the reason he chose me is that he knew I was technically excellent. I wouldn't lie to him. I would treat him with kindness. I would treat him with honesty. And I can't tell you, in this context, he allowed me to see his daughter because he knew that I wasn't going to sexually ogle her. So a lot of what most nurses, dentists, and physicians, Christian physicians, we already have this baseline of integrity. We already have this baseline of wanting to love people. We want to be technically excellent. And you go into a place that's dark and you do that, and people start looking at you and they're like, what's the matter with you? Why are you like this? And they will come and find you. And as a result of this interaction with my friend, I've had a chance to speak into his life. We have discussions now. So evangelism, I really think, for the marketplace worker is you do your job so well, so technically excellent, but you do it with love. You do it with the love of Christ, with valuing people, and they will find you. And however you choose to do that, it depends on your specialty. So that's at work. Then at home, what we often do is the Muslim world, they love to eat. So we have people over. We have hospitality. My kids, they're in a football league with locals. I'm known as the guy in my compound where we live, as all the kids bring their bikes to me to fix because a lot of their fathers won't fix their bikes. And because a lot of these places are in the middle of the desert, you have a bike and you can go 10 feet and the tire will pop. So it's just simple things. Like I was fixing bike tires and bikes for my kids in the U.S. I do that where I am, and people flock to you.
How else has it affected your wife and your children? Of course, they're living cross-culturally as well. And I know people always have a lot of questions like, well, yeah, I can do the professionalism. I could go and work in this country. What's it like to live there? How's it going to affect my family?
So I can't speak to all contexts, but in my context, it is a challenge. But the thing that I always say to people is one of the things I really enjoy about the Muslim world is I feel like a lot of their differences from us, or what I would say their golden calves, their idols, they're very well marked and they're very clear about it. So there is a much, I think, to some degree, a greater sense of evil and good in the Muslim world. Whereas when we come now back to the U.S., I feel that the U.S. has a lot of issues, and so much of the sin in our culture is so well hidden. All of our golden calves are camouflaged. So when people ask me this, I would say, number one, it is a challenge, but there are challenges here in the U.S., and I think maybe we're more comfortable with them because we know them. But I try to just tell people, look, it's not perfect in the U.S. It's not perfect over there. But the other thing I will tell you, and this is hard to explain until you experience, expatriate living, which is basically, as an American, I live in Asia, so I'm not of that passport country, but I'm not really of American passport anymore. Expatriates tend to find each other. So a lot of the other missionaries and workers are Korean, they're Kenyan, they're from all over the world. And expatriate living is so, so rich. We are in a home church, so you find very quickly what matters for church. So you get great relationships. My wife would actually say that her social life is better in Asia than it is in the U.S., simply because she opens up the house every Wednesday. She has ladies, local ladies over, and then other friends over, kids over. And so we actually have a pretty rich life personally, because much of the Eastern world is so relationship-oriented, whereas you come back to the States, and a lot of that is gone. Now, there are challenges, absolutely. My wife, she has to dress a certain way. We're very limited in our movements because of just travel restrictions. And you definitely, it has to be a joint discussion. And when I mobilize other people, I often say, you know, if your spouse is not feeling like they want to go, don't go. You can be intentional here. So it can be an absolute challenge for the women. There's I think the other issue too is this concept of the trailing spouse. That often happens not just in missions, but in the State Department. And some person has a professional identity, and the other person generally, because of the laws of the country, can't work. And that's true for my wife and I. My wife is a physician, and she has chosen to homeschool our four children rather than working as a physician, because I can tell you in our context, there is absolutely no way we could both work. It is a very challenge just to have one of us working, so we need a safe environment for our family. And we've just made the decision to homeschool our children. Educational issues can be often a challenge for families, I think in general, very often one of the complaints of missionaries is missionaries tend to congregate around capital cities. And we do that because that tends to be where the educational opportunities are for children. So it definitely is more complicated if you have children. We are actually planning on putting our kids in a local school as one of our children get older. But the other side, though, so that's my wife. I think my wife has got some challenges, but I think she also really enjoys it. My wife also says, too, and I found this to be true, she would say her prayer life is so much better there than here. Her spiritual life is so much better there than here. And I think part of that is that, at least for me as an American passport holder, this place is easy. There's Christians everywhere. When you go to these places where there's no Christian presence, you suddenly have to make, you kind of have to make a decision, like, is Christ really worth it? And I will tell you, it is challenging. And the question that I often get is how challenging it is. But the answer to that is not how challenging it is that God is so much bigger than all of this. God will show up. My time in Asia has, and my wife would say this too, our time is not about what we have done. It is what about God has done in us. It's going to be messy. It's going to be challenging, but God will show up. He may not show up when you want. He may not show up how you want, but he will show up. You are not alone. So there is a challenge, but the great thing is you're not alone. God comes with you. And then, so that's kind of me, my wife, and then my kids. I think my kids, so it's kind of funny. I have a 10, 7, 5, and 4-year-old. I think they're actually, of anyone, doing the best. They're the most resilient. We have now been there for almost 4 years, and they say home to them is Asia. They don't consider the U.S. home. So we are here traveling in the U.S. right now, but they don't see this as home. They've made friends there. They think in meters. They speak with British accents. And so the kids, I think if you do a good job kind of preparing them and loving them, they will do fine.
Yeah. And it's a rich experience for them too. I think most people don't realize that being overseas helps them to relate cross-culturally, be comfortable with adults, comfortable with children. They know how to travel. The list just goes on and on and on of the opportunities they have. And you grow very close as a family because you're facing challenges together, which is we can easily leave separate lives as healthcare professionals if we're not careful.
One of my friends who's a Christian here, when we came back, he asked me this question. He said, Joseph, aren't you afraid that your child is going to convert to Islam because you live in the Muslim world? And what I said to him, and I think for those of you who are concerned as parents, I said, absolutely not. My son, at a very young age, has to make a choice. He is faced daily with the realities of what Islam is and what Christianity is. And we have daily conversations about Christianity. We have daily conversations about Islam. And so I would actually say, my response to that is, I would be more concerned about my child converting to Islam in America than I would in Asia. So there is a sense of, at a very early age, your children can take ownership of their own faith. And I have seen it in my 10 and 7-year-old. It's been really cool. The other issue, too, is if you're going to bring kids overseas, there is this concept called third culture kids. I'm assuming you've talked about this before. There are multiple books on it. But I would highly recommend anyone considering going overseas reading up on the concept of third culture kids, because that's what your children will become.
Yep, and it's got its positives and negatives. I think the positives far outweigh the negatives, but there's some things you can do to help on the other side. Joe, thank you so much for your testimony, what you're doing, and for challenging us as Christian healthcare professionals to consider ministry in such a context. You're a great example to all of us, and I want to thank you for what you've done.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. And it is just my prayer that people would earnestly seek his will. And like I said, I don't care if you come to my area of the world, but I do think we're all called as followers of Christ. We have to go. Sometimes it's more challenging to go across the street, but we'd love to have more people come across the ocean.
It was great to have Joe on, and I heartily recommend Third Culture Kids. That book is excellent. I've read it. And it's not just for people that are missionaries and dealing with their own kids, but for all those who know missionary kids like you and me. Really helps you understand the advantages they've had and the challenges they have because of where they were raised and how they were raised. It's a good read. Also want to recommend another excellent book called When Mission Shapes the Mission, and You and Your Church Can Reach the World. It's a real book on strategy and missions. I think it'll open your eyes. It's done that for a lot of folks. It's available here at CMDA. You can give us a call at 888-230-2637, and one of my excellent staff will help you. Or if you prefer, you can go on cmda.org and just put in the name, When Missions Shape the Mission, or go to our Life and Health Resource area, and you'll find that book listed there. I trust you'll get it and read it. I think all of us need to keep attuned to what's happening in missions, both the opportunities and challenges, and how we as healthcare professionals can help take the gospel around the world. Let me update you on some great conferences. Always popular are our marriage enrichment weekends. What a wonderful time with your mate. Just devoted on making your marriage better and being with other couples in a lovely site and a beautiful resort. February 1st through the 3rd, there's one in Miramar Beach, Florida. What a great time of the year to be in Florida in the winter. April 5th through the 7th, there's one in Georgetown, Colorado. This is a Women Physicians in Christ event designed for female healthcare professionals and their spouses. And that particular focus is one we try to do every year, and a great time of year to be in Colorado. March 28th through the 30th will be our second Remedy Medical Missions Conference at the First Baptist Church of Orlando, Florida. This is a mission conference similar to what we've been doing at Global Missions Health Conference in Louisville for years. We're now trying to take that other places around the country so people don't have to drive so far. We know most people come within about a six-hour drive of Louisville. And we've got some great speakers there. Dr. Omari Hodge, Dr. Mike Chupp will be speaking, the new CEO of CMDA starting this fall. And Mike's got a rich medical experience. Dr. Dave Thompson, one of my favorite speakers, an elder statesman in medical missions, the founder of PACS, and others will be there. I hope you'll come, bring some others with you. It'll be a great weekend of looking at the Great Commission and how we can help fulfill it around the world. And then May 2nd through the 5th, we've got our national convention. This is a special one, or at least they tell me that, because it's really focused on celebrating transformation, what God's done over the last 25 years. I'll be giving my final address as CEO. Mike Chupp will be speaking as the new CEO, as well as a great lineup of John Stone Street, Nancy Piercy, the apologist. Stan Key's going to be the Bible teacher, and it's just going to be a marvelous time of fellowship in beautiful Ridgecrest Conference Center in North Carolina, one of my favorite places that time of year. To find out more about all these conferences or to register, just go online at cmda.org. Or if you've got questions, don't hesitate to give us a call or just to register on the phone. Call us at 888-230-2637. You'll probably hear our sweet Carol at the desk, and she's a wonder hostess. I tell her she's the vice president of First Impressions, and she is with many of our members as they call in to the organization. It's a delight to have John Patrick back at the microphone. If you don't know John, or this is the first time you've heard him, his background is he was trained at King College in London. He's was born and raised in the UK, did his clinical work at St. George's Hospital, held appointments in Britain, the West Indies, and Canada. Main academic interest has been in the treatment of protein energy malnutrition and accident trauma throughout the world. He even did research and lived for a number of years in the West Indies. Came to Canada in 1980 and was associate professor at the University of Ottawa for over 20 years. But he has a great interest in apologetics, has spoken to Christian and secular groups all over the world on medical ethics, culture, public policy, integration of faith and science. He speaks frequently not only for CMDA, but also the Christian Medical and Dental Society of Canada and our sister organizations all over the world. John and his wife, Sally, live in Canada. They have four grown children and 21 grandchildren. Their oldest daughter and her family are missionaries in Malawi, and the rest of their kids and grandkids live close to them around Ottawa. It's always a delight to have my good friend John Patrick with me at the microphone. We've got a great time in store. John, it's great to have you back on Christian Doctors Digest. Always a treat. You always challenge me. And today we're going to talk about a topic that foundations of life. Where are you going to go with that?
Well, when you look around, clearly the foundations are being shaken at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
I saw a figure the other day that 80% of incarcerated males in North America have had no father in their lives. And yet you have a leadership undermining marriage on every opportunity until relatively recently anyway.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's like committed marriages are just unnecessary. They're not needed. Do what feels good. Go with what you like to do. And boy, that has an impact on kids and ultimately our culture.
Yeah, and it's had an impact even on the way we in the evangelical wing of the church present the gospel, hasn't it? It can easily degenerate into a feel-good experience, whereas in actual fact, that certainly wasn't what Paul intended. I love misquoting Paul when I'm preaching to see if the congregation are alert. One of the favorite ones is to say, Paul, writing to the Corinthians, says, the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who have been saved, it is the power of God. And I have just trashed the cultural history of the Western world in one sentence, and it appears that none of you have noticed.
Explain.
Well, the error is small but vital. It's the verb. I misquoted by saying, but to those who have been saved, but it's not have been, it's are being saved.
Mm-hmm.
It's present continuous for Paul. And he frequently says to people, I know it's worth praying for you because your faith is alive. Now there are things to pray about.
Yeah.
We have lost that. I mean, have you ever heard a pastor on Sunday morning say, please, can we devote the prayers from the congregation this morning to people giving thanks for the ways in which they have been saved in the last week?
I never have.
No, nor I. And yet, it seems to me that's exactly what Paul wants. And as you look at the world at the moment, our Lord never set up a committee meeting. He gave no instructions on how to run institutions. He started with character. And it astonishes me more and more as I go back to it again and again and again that he says, look, the bottom line is you're a mess. So the first step forward is the happiness that comes from acknowledging that. Even Jordan Peterson says that. He says to audiences, wherever he goes, he says, we're all a mess. We know what is good, but we're not doing very well. And he's not yet a Christian, but he can't stay in that position for long. I mean, his feet are firmly planted on a rock, which he hasn't yet recognized. But we're not doing anywhere near as good a job as he has. He is in getting to people who don't go to church and getting to think what are really Christian ideas to a considerable degree. And he understands that. It's astonishing. I don't know whether I've spoken to you since I had the privilege of sharing a conference with him with a couple of others. Have I spoken to you since?
I don't think so.
Because it was astonishing, and I'm sure physicians listening will be interested, and it might provoke them into a bit more activity. It was last fall, but the invitation came about a year before that. And Sally said, you've got an unusual invitation. And I said, what is it? She said, well, you've been asked by a Catholic family group to talk at a conference they're having, which is on the liturgy of life. It doesn't sound like you to me. I said, no, but it's certainly an interesting opportunity. And I'd love to find out what it's like. So say yes. shortly afterwards, or a few months later, one of the organizers sent me a note, and it turned out that she knew of me through you, basically through Doctor's Digest tapes and CDs. And she said, I just wanted to bring you up to speed. I was in Portland visiting a favorite priest of mine, and I was enthusing about our conference. And he said, well, tell me, who are the main speakers? And she said, well, Jordan Peterson's the main one. And he said, I've no idea who he is. Anybody else? And he said, John Patrick. He said, oh, I know him. I'll come. That's the only time in my life that I will have upstaged, at least in theory, Jordan Peterson. But I began to take some interest in him and was fascinated by what he had to say and what I think the Lord is doing to him. Anyway, the conference was really very interesting. And what was really striking, and he said it's the normal thing, is that there were a lot of young men there you don't expect at family conferences. And they'd come to hear Jordan Peterson. And when he'd finished a talk, there was a line of, you know, it took 45 minutes to get through. And he said, well, they just want to say thank you. How long is it since Christians have had people queuing up to say thank you for presenting the gospel? Mm. And what they like is his obvious concern that they're being sold a pup and abused intellectually. So he's concerned for them. His passion and his openness and his willingness to be politically incorrect. He's very clever at it. He never makes a statement without asking a question. He sets it up beautifully. I don't know if you've listened to him at all yet.
No, I've not. You're making me curious, though.
You have to. Particularly, you should go and put in Jordan Peterson in Britain, being interviewed by a feminist who's made her reputation by taking men apart, and he takes her apart. Mm. Her name has gone from me at the moment. That's a kindness. But it's 20 minutes or so in which she tries to take him apart, and it finishes with him realizing he's won, and he says, I've got you, haven't I? And she said, yes, you have. I don't know what to say.
Wow.
And it went viral in the millions within a week. Mm. And he's now the most widely known public intellectual in the world, with millions of followers. He's got his own YouTube site, but you put Jordan Peterson into YouTube and you get dozens of things, lots of which will interest you. So close and yet still so far. And I said to him at the end of that conference, you know where this pathway ends, don't you? And he said, yes, but it's going to take a while to get there.
Hmm.
But he's so close. You know, he says the Logos is what is at the heart of what it means to be a human being. God created a world. You know, he didn't say God created. He said the world we've been given is pregnant with possibilities, and Logos makes it possible, what we know in our souls.
Wow.
And he claims not to be a Christian. He's incredibly close. But he's got lessons for us about the passions that need to be understood. I mean, he stood up to the government and said, you are attacking freedom of speech. No government can tell you what to think. Now, I was going to start this session with you, and I haven't, but I'll put it in now. I wanted to read something to you, which is a very famous 20, 30, 40 words by one of your most famous presidents. He wrote this: of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. Do you know where that comes from?
I was thinking either Washington or Lincoln, or there could be someone else.
It's Washington.
Yeah.
It's from his final speech, his final address, which apparently, I didn't know this, they read in the Senate every year. I wish they'd take more notice of it.
Yeah, boy, my goodness, yes.
But for us as evangelicals, the thing that's bothered me over the years is the recognition that Christ doesn't tell us to be successful evangelists. He tells us to go and witness to what Christ has done in our lives, and to produce fruit that gives glory to God. There's a sense in which we're given the dignity of causality. People come to Christ, and we have an agency in that of some sort, and it's an incredibly great privilege that should be so. But all we're required to do is bear witness and produce fruit. Mm-hmm. I think we've lost a bit of that, haven't we?
It's easy to, and you think it's performance-based. I've got to see certain results, where you don't realize that God does, the Holy Spirit does the work.
Yeah.
And your faithfulness, God allows you to be there sometimes when he does it, and many times not.
I mean, you must have the experience that I have of, as you travel around, people coming and saying to you, thank you so much, and you have no memory of what they're talking about.
Absolutely. In fact, it happened to me in India after I spoke, and all these people started coming up, and I'm going, I've never met you before. But, you know, through a book, through writing, through an audio recording, you know, it's just, you never, that's what the first million years of heaven is going to be, I think, is finding out all God did that you knew, had no idea what he was doing.
Oh, the interconnections are just amazing. And as Lewis puts, I think in the Screwtape Letters, he has little interest in our wars and politics. They are of no eternal significance. So all the terrible things that are going on, he allows them. I mean, it's right there in the scriptures, isn't it? Is there evil in the city and the Lord has not done it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is a situationalist. He allows things which are awful to happen to us because, as it says in to me, the most frightening pro-life chapter in the Bible, where in Ezekiel, I think it's chapter 30 or thereabouts, where he's telling through Ezekiel the children of Israel, they've become idolatrous, they haven't recognized who he is, and he says, they're not keeping my Sabbath. And so he says, I have allowed them to go astray. I have given them ways of living, idols that cannot support their life. I have caused them to offer their firstborn to Moloch, of course. And then he says, I did it to horrify them, that they might return to me. He doesn't mind how far he goes to horrify us if that's what's necessary.
Yeah.
I mean, you see it and I've seen it. Some terrible disaster happens in Africa. And then you meet Christians who are in the middle of it and suddenly say things like, well, I wouldn't wish this on anyone, but I have learned more about prayer and about God in the last few months than I have in the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. God never wastes pain and suffering. He always uses them if you allow him to.
Yeah. So the question is, how do we get to the point where we become a more serious people again? I think we've become somber where we should be sober. But we should be sober and joyful, not somber and joyless. But our joy is a rational joy, you know, and he says, when you are persecuted, rejoice. That's a command. So it cannot be a feeling because we do not have the ability to command our feelings. So, but then he gives us two reasons. Look at the company you've joined and look at the reward in heaven. It's a rational reason for rejoicing in suffering. Paul knows it. He says, I want to complete the sufferings of Christ. This has to be mined. And something else I was looking at just, I'll read this too. This is Bonhoeffer's prayer that was written in the days before he was executed. In fact, it says shortly before his execution. And this is the prayer, by gracious power so wonderfully sheltered, and constantly waiting what may come. He knew what was coming. We know that God is with us night and morning, and never fails to greet us each new day. Yet in this heart, by its old foe tormented, still evil days bring burdens hard to bear. O give our frightened souls the sure salvation, for which, O Lord, you taught us to prepare. And when this cup you give is filled to brimming, with bitter sufferings hard to understand, we take it thankfully and without trembling, out of so good and so beloved a hand. Yet when again in this same world you give us the joy we had, the brightness of your sons, we shall remember all the days we lived through, and our whole life shall then be yours alone.
Wow.
To write that as you're about to have a piano wire around your neck is quite something.
Yes, yes. And the poetry and the beauty of it and the surety, it just shines through.
And I sometimes don't want to pray because I don't think I can say anything that's adequate in the view of what other people have written when they prayed. You know, how often has prayer stopped you and given you a lump in your throat in church?
Mm.
It should, I think. So the only solution must be that we have in some sense to repent and ask for mercy and guidance and the blessing of being able to do those things. I mean, he prepares people to do it, and those that can are being silent, I presume. I love two of my Old Testament favorite characters, Bezalel and Oholiab.
those aren't near the top of my list, but go ahead.
Well, they are mine. So I'll explain why. When Moses is being given the instructions for making the tabernacle, I can put myself in Moses' shoes and say, well, I know what he was thinking. How am I supposed to do this? And God knows what he's thinking. And when he's let him suffer for a while, as he sort of takes it all down and makes notes or whatever he did, he says, oh, by the way, I have given the gifts that are required to Oholiab and Bezalel. They can make all these things that I have told you to do, including the Ark of the Covenant and everything else. But he had given the gifts to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's all gifts. I mean, your incredible capacities to have a vision of something, as in Tenwick, change a one-man band into the best teaching hospital in Kenya in, you know, less than 20 years. That was a gift, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was definitely
sure,
the Lord.
Did a lot of work, but you knew that you were not alone in that.
Yeah,
that's what matters. That's what always matters. And I don't think we're modeling that sufficiently. In fact, even my wife has trouble when I say, I think we need to say the things that happened to us. She says, but it sounds so much like boasting. I said, well, I hope not. But this summer, for instance, I got two emails. And you're partly involved in this, too. They're both from doctors, one in the Midwest and another in New Jersey. And they both were talking about a talk they'd heard 20 years before. Mm-hmm. Not in the same place, I don't think. They didn't say where, but it was what Hippocrates knew and we've forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And both these two docs had remembered the four key points. And in this last year, they had come home to roost in a big way as they began to see how far medicine had fallen because of losing the sense that without God, we don't have any medicine. Without transcendence, it will fall apart because you have no reason to trust someone with your life if they don't fear judgment for that life after death. And so both these folks had reordered their lives in the last year to find somehow a place where they could practice medicine with those principles in place for as long as possible. Because I'm not sure how long the young are going to be allowed to do these things. We really do need to be thinking hard about how we set ourselves up to demand that we be treated with as much respect as any other minority in terms of having, if you're a rationalist and a nihilist, then the last act of your own volition is to say, kill me.
Mm-hmm.
Who can deny that to an atheist? But to insist that a Christian must do it is to fail to recognize what that would do to the Christian's story of meaning. And surely a Christian patient has as much right to know that the doctors caring for me will under no circumstances kill me as the other way around.
Yeah.
We so often try to argue our way into winning our position, whereas I think what we should be doing much more is telling our story and saying, doesn't our story have as much right to exist as yours? It's been around longer. It's got far less in the way of troubles attached to its name. You know, if you want to know who screwed the world up in the last century, they're all atheists. From the French Revolution on, the French Revolution, the Nazis, Hitler, Stalin, Lenin, Mao, Pol Pot, they were all totalitarian atheists and socialists, they said, who didn't care about people because they didn't understand what we should understand. As Lewis said, the holiest thing you meet every day is your neighbor. If you could see him or her as they will be in heaven, you would be tempted to worship.
Hmm.
But we're kept so busy, we don't have time to stand back and think about these things, do we?
No, or to act upon them either. I mean, I'm too busy. That's our excuse. And we are busy, but it's not an excuse.
Yeah. And we're seeing the whole thing being taken away from us because of that. Late, I've been reading quite a lot of stuff by a guy called Roger Scruton. I don't know if you've come across him. The book lying on my desk at the moment is called Confessions of a Heretic. It says on the front, "We individuals who have a deep suspicion of government have a yet deeper need for it. Government is wrapped into the very fibers of our social being," and he explains how that has happened. He's a brilliant writer, and at the end of it, he talks about defending our heritage. You know, the young people coming out of the arts faculty at the moment are taught to hate their own culture, to be saying mea culpa the whole time, and yet everybody wants to come and live in this mea culpa environment. They don't want to live elsewhere. Yeah, well, everybody screws up as Christians. We know that. We set out to do good and we do evil, and often we didn't intend it. But he at the end of the book, lists seven things which he says we need to think about seriously because they have made us who we are. And I doubt that most of us could put this all together. He starts with citizenship and says, "Law made legitimate by the consent of the people." Or submission to reveal law like Sharia? No. Common law, a residue of human agreements. For Muslims, no distinction between law and morality. Their rulers are often assassinated. The privatization of religion in the West is a miracle. The fact that we have, for all these years, held rights of religion actually sacrosanct until the last little while in the Western world. We're suffering more in Canada more than you are in the U.S. I mean, gee, your present president, who, for me, when I was looking at the choices, well, he was the better of two evils. I prefer a rogue who I can understand their roguishness to an ideologue who's malicious. Surely that's what the difference was. And as one of our best journalists, Conrad Black, says, the swamp needs draining, and you often need a brash and arrogant person to do it. Let's hope he does it. And in the process, the Bible studies started in the White House might do something good for his soul. The second thing on Scruton's list is loyalty. We the people, our land. Muslims don't have that sense at all, and most Muslim nations are failed states. He's comparing the two. Christianity, which says, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and give to God the things that are God's. And he leaves us, as usual, to go and think about that, and we've been thinking about it forever. Hmm. He puts irony forth. A lot of people recognize how important this is now. But Christ's judgment and parables look on the spectacle of human folly and wrongdoing and show us how to live with it, make acceptance of it possible. We need self-criticism. We need adversarial law procedures. And his number seven won't go down well with our listeners, but you can think about it. He says free association with a little alcohol. What he's pointing out is that many of us are tongue-tied, and drunkenness is forbidden, but a little wine makes bad the heart of man, and a little for your stomach's sake is probably good news. And certainly, so many people do, in fact, when they get together under social circumstances where they don't intend to annoy one another, actually deal with a lot of problems in the past. I don't think we have the beginnings of an understanding of how rich our history is and how saturated it is with Christianity. Flannery O'Connor calls the South where you live the Christ-haunted South. It's a lovely phrase.
Hmm.
Sorry, yeah, I went off on a sermon. You should have stopped me.
I've never learned to do that, John. I want to thank you for your faithfulness. And I mean, how many places you've been, how many times you've spoken, only God knows. And how many conversations in between, and how many students you've spent the night with late. And God has used you mightily in so many people's lives. And let me, on behalf of our 19,000-plus members, say a huge thank you to you and for joining us once again.
Well, thank you very much. And I want a special thank you to those who paid my travel bills to Africa and the place, whose names I do not know. But you will be blessed. Thank you.
If you'd like to get more John Patrick, we've got lots of resources from CDs to video series to all sorts of things. You can go on our website and just put in his name and it'll give you a listing of those things. or call our office. Talk to one of our staff. They'd be happy to help you. I can't get enough of John Patrick, and I go back and have to listen again and again because they're so rich and there's so much information that's helpful to us in this world we live in right now. Well, as we close this issue of Christian Doctor's Digest, I've been kind of doing a series updating you on different parts of CMDA, and CMDA has grown so large. There's so many things we do. I have people walk up to me all the time and say, I wish CMDA did this, and I'll say, well, we do, and they just hadn't caught that fact. And this time, I want to talk about our key result area of voice, and that's our public policy. A couple of things we've been focused on recently is really trying to open the conduit between USAID, our tax dollars, and our missionaries overseas. We believe that our government really misses out when they don't work with faith-based organizations overseas, because these people there know the culture as missionaries. They know the language. They're going to be there, most of them, a lifetime. And, you know, oftentimes the government gets involved in flash-in-the-pan type things where, you know, it's a year or so and some big group comes in and does something and that's it. And so not long ago, we did a large survey of our missionary members. Over 100 organizations responded, put that data together, really looking at why they don't work with USAID. What are the barriers? What are they concerned about? Is it because it's too difficult to apply? And we got a bunch of great information, put that into a presentation with specific recommendations, and passed it out all over Washington. Just this last week, Jonathan sent me a picture. And it was the ambassador on HIV/AIDS had been speaking, and she held up our survey report and waved it in front of the organization and said, we need to be working with these groups. USAID now has done a whole training session online for faith-based organizations on how to apply and how to identify opportunities for funding. And it's making a huge difference. I think even a bigger difference coming as we get funding available in hospitals and other medical programs around the world. And made it very clear, and USAID is taking out stuff that has been barriers, complete reproductive services, which is a euphemism for abortion. They've taken that kind of wording out. And then we've been educating our members to, you know, you pay for your spiritual ministry, let them pay for your health ministry or buildings or whatever, and keep very clear records, and everything works out great. So a lot of good things happening. We continue to focus a lot on healthcare freedoms, freedom of conscience in healthcare, and that is so important. We're trying to get some new legislation with broader coverage through Congress, and have been pushing that for a number of months now. We continue to be very active on physician-assisted suicide, abortion, genetic issues, all sorts of things that are coming up. You probably read some articles not too long ago on some of the gene editing is done, and they had actually edited genes and embryos and some of the ethical implications of that. I want to encourage you to go online if you've got concerns about an issue and want a real concise, well-documented statement on physician-assisted suicide or transgender or whatever it may be. There are over 50 ethical statements on our website at cmda.org, and they're excellent kind of crib sheets going over all the social issues, scientific issues, biblical issues, moral issues on these topics, and then helping you to know how to speak out and how to navigate some of the landmines around these topics. We're also very active at the state level. The American Academy of Medical Ethics, kind of an arm of CMDA that we started, now has over 62 volunteer state physician directors fighting physician-assisted suicide legalization in their state, or trying to limit it where it actually has been legalized. And we work very closely with them, give them media training, teach them how to talk to legislators, all sorts of stuff. And we're addressing other topics besides that. We're coming out with some new statements on medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, some of the other hot topics here in this country, to give you some guidance as well. And the board will be looking at these in the next few months. Lots of things going on the public policy. We're doing 300 to 400 media interviews still each year. Just yesterday, I wrote an op-ed piece for our own local newspaper here because physician-assisted suicide was in the news. We do that at the national level. We're blogging. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're using every modality you can imagine to let our views be known, not only to the government, but to the church and to healthcare professionals out there and to our culture. So pray for this area and pray that God will continue to use it. We want to speak the truth in love. We want to speak the truth with factual backup for the assertions that we're making. And we want to love on people even as we disagree with them. And I think that's so important in this day and time. So pray for us as we are your spokesman on key issues. And we hope you'll get involved at the local level or even beyond that. If God's moving in your heart, we're here to help you and to be effective and to make a difference on these important issues in our day and time. Well, I trust you've enjoyed this Christian Doctor's Digest issue as much as I've enjoyed doing these interviews. I look forward to getting together again with you. And until we do, be sure of our prayers that God will use you to spread his kingdom, give you the strength, courage, and wisdom that you need, and we'll praise God for what he's going to do.
Christian Doctor's Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctor's Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctor's Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.